Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk. Few, if any, lawmakers have punched back more forcefully and more adroitly against the Trump MAGA agenda than Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland. Feisty and irrepressible Raskin, a constitutional law professor, was a House manager in Donald Trump's second impeachment trial, served as a key member of the January 6th committee, and from his seats on House Judiciary and Oversight, he has zealously clashed with the panel's Republican leaders over their efforts to investigate what they like to call the Biden crime family. And now, on the eve of the election, Raskin isn't slowing down. He, along with Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, has just fired off a letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland, urging him to open up a criminal investigation into somebody Raskin's fans would no doubt call a member of the Trump crime family. In particular, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who Raskin and Wyden argue should be investigated by a special counsel to determine if he is serving as an unregistered foreign agent of the Saudi government. We'll talk to Raskin about the Kushner case and why he thinks it raises troubling questions about the foreign entanglements of the Trump family and its potential national security implications, as well as what plans he's making for what could be turbulent times after next week's election on this edition of Spy Talk. Congressman Raskin, happy Halloween.
Indeed. Happy Halloween.
Who are you? Will there be kids dressed as the ghost of democracy going around Tacoma Park tonight?
Well, I'm going to be passing out constitutions along with candy.
I don't know how enthusiastic your kids will be. Look, I obviously want to talk about your recent letter on Jared Kushner and foreign influence in American politics and with the Trump organization in particular. But look, we're 5 days out right now from a enormously consequential election. How do you feel?
Well, I've been out to 27 states, Mike, and I just returned from my sixth and final trip to Pennsylvania. And, I'm seeing just huge overflowing crowds of Democrats in urban areas and suburban areas, in the rural areas. I spoke to a dinner in Berks County, Pennsylvania, in Reading, which is a traditionally more conservative area. It was the largest dinner they ever had with like 600 people. That's what I'm finding everywhere I go. So there's tremendous engagement and involvement. There's a lot of anxiety, of course, because the stakes are so high and there's a real propaganda push on the right wing to try and demoralize everybody. But the reality is if you look at the entire course of this basically 100-day campaign, President Biden's decision to pass the mantle has had an electrifying effect across the country. The Democratic convention was just a massive success. And I think we're going all the way. And I think Trump is going down hard. He has not presented any real program to the country. There's no real platform that they're running on. And that's characteristic of an authoritarian political campaign where you don't put issues before the public to debate, right, but you just engage in scapegoating and racist and misogynistic and anti-Semitic and, you know, gay bashing kind of rhetoric. And I think that's where we are. I mean, it's closer than it should be, but I think it's going the right way.
Well, I want to return to election stuff a little later on, but I want to start out with the letter you just wrote to Attorney General Merrick Garland asking him to appoint a special counsel to investigate Jared Kushner for being an unregistered agent of the Saudi government. Can you just lay out your case of why you think this requires a criminal investigation by the Justice Department at this point?
Well, I mean, it's a crime to engage in the activities of representing a foreign state, a foreign government, without registering. I mean, that's what FAR is all about, is to get people to register. So he brings back $2 billion from the homicidal crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. None of that money has been invested, so there's no returns on it. So Saudi Arabia is not getting anything out of it, and yet they're paying hundreds of millions in management fees. I believe Jared Kushner has picked up already more than $70 million in management fees for a fund that has no investments and it's not rendering anything of value. So it looks very much like a sweetheart payoff contract deal. Meantime, Jared Kushner continues to advance Saudi Arabia's political interests in Republican circles, to advise the Saudi government and to promote their views. So, I mean, it's hard to resist the conclusion that he's acting as a very well paid foreign agent.
So it seems to me that the management fees that you learned about through a briefing that the chief legal officer for Kushner's company, Affinity Partners, gave Senate Finance Committee, chaired by Ron Wyden, who signed your letter. And that was new, I believe, the confirmation that it's not just the $2 billion that the crown prince invested in Kushner's company from the start, but they're continuing to pay him. So I'm presuming that that's you believe that makes this a stronger case.
I mean, that's the critical element, because the way these contracts work is that you get a management fee that's a percentage of the overall fund that you're managing. I mean, and who knows what real agreement they have? Maybe the Saudis don't want them to really do anything with the money. They'd rather just keep the corpus rather than have it squandered by Jared Kushner and his college roommates or whoever else is working for him. But in any event, it's that fee. I think most Americans would agree that a $70 million annual fee is a very sweet compensation. It would certainly put him in the top 100th of 1% of Americans in terms of salaried compensation.
By the way, your letter says he's collected $157 million in management fees from foreign investors, including $87 million from the Saudi fund.
Yeah. I understated it. It was $87 million. Okay. $87 million is an extraordinary sum of money. I mean, most people will not earn that over the course of their whole lives, much less than, you know, a single year. And the idea that Jared Kushner, as the principal foreign policy actor, at least certainly for the Middle East, for Donald Trump, is not acting in the capacity of a foreign agent, just cries out for correction. It just makes no sense.
Now, the foreign agent law that you invoke for this says that the agent has to be engaged in political activities defined as seeking to influence any agency or official of the United States government or any section of the public. So what is the evidence that Jared Kushner, in his new private role, private businessman, he's not in government, is seeking to influence the United States government or the public?
Well,
on behalf of the Saudi government.
Right. And I mean, this is why what we're asking for is an investigation into what's happening. But we know that he's both continued to advise Trump on foreign policy, which suggests that he's certainly not going to be advising Trump to do anything with respect to Saudi Arabia or the Middle East that contradicts Saudi policy. And very likely he's acting as a courier for the views and the interests of Saudi Arabia. You know, and similarly, he advises Saudi Arabia on what's taking place in American politics. So look, there's just this network of embedded conflicts of interest that operate around Trump world. And this is one more of them. But I just don't think we should be establishing a precedent that you can essentially go on the payroll of a foreign government in the guise of being their investment manager, even if the funds are never invested, take that money, advance the views of the foreign state, and not register. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Now, you know, you said that the Saudis haven't gotten anything. Of course, there haven't been any deals. But Affinity has announced deals in the Balkans in particular. I wrote about one in Serbia in which they're basically in business with the pro-Russian Serbian government. And as part of the build a residential hotel complex. And as part of that, they're going to build a memorial to, according to the Serbian government press release of this, at the victims of NATO aggression.
Yeah.
And Jared Kushner's doing that.
Well, look, the America First family is putting pretty much every tyrant and dictator and despot on earth first, because it's a money-making opportunity. And the idea is to cement all of these deals with foreign states before the election in the hopes that they'll win the election. But then Trump will say, we will not create any new deals with foreign states, but they will continue to execute the deals and complete the business arrangements they've already entered into.
But that's not Trump is the Trump organization. This is Kushner's own company. I mean, he's not under any obligation to curtail any of his activities, right? I mean,
correct. To the extent that you are acting in fact as a representative of a foreign government, you must be registered by law as a representative of a foreign government. And if it's not exactly what it looks like, then you know, he should explain why. But the business part of it, at least up until this point, looks essentially like a pretense for either a pay back to the Trumps or a pay off to the Trumps. Or now it's just a reciprocal and mutually beneficial relationship between a royal autocratic dictatorial family in Saudi Arabia and one in America, which aspires to play the same role here.
So last question on this, because I think you can probably anticipate some of the pushback you're going to get on this. There's been a lot of talk over the last couple of years about the weaponization of the Justice Department, in which both sides accuse the other of using the Justice Department to investigate political enemies of the other, right? And certainly there's been plenty of evidence that Trump tried to do that, but some Republicans could look at this and say, hey, Raskin and Wyden, you know, two Democrats on the eve of the election are trying to weaponize the Justice Department to investigate a political enemy, in this case, Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of Donald Trump. And just to add one little beat of that, it is not at all unusual for top advisors to presidential campaigns to have all sorts of business interests. Kamala Harris's top advisor is her brother-in-law, Tony West, who was, until recently, the senior vice president, chief counsel of Uber, still has millions of dollars in stock. By the way, the Saudis have invested $3.5 billion in Uber. So, you know, how will you respond to folks who say, look, this is just a political exercise by you that shouldn't really be taken as seriously as you would like it to be?
The role of the Department of Justice is to enforce the law. And the Foreign Agent Registration Act is a law. Some people might not like it. Some people might want to repeal it, but it's a law and it should be enforced by the government. And it should obviously be enforced under rule of law principles based on evidence, based on facts. And, you know, I have no reason to believe any right-wing propaganda about the weaponization of the Department of Justice. I mean, they have openly proclaimed that that's their goal. They want to use the Department of Justice as a weapon of what Donald Trump said in the opening of his campaign was retribution against his political opponents. That's naked. That's just out there. That's how he wants to use it. They assert that the prosecutions related to the people who assaulted federal officers and tried to overthrow the 2020 election and set aside the Constitution are somehow political in nature. There's not a single court that has vacated anybody's conviction or quashed anybody's indictment on the grounds that it was a form of vindictive or selective prosecution. So there's no basis for that claim in law. And I think most Americans would be horrified to think that, you know, hundreds of people could violently assault officers and not be charged for it, or that Donald Trump could himself attempt to interfere with the peaceful transfer of power and just get away with it. Now, of course, the Supreme Court has perhaps different thoughts about that, but, yes. You know, I mean, we're still in the middle of that litigation, but the same Department of Justice that they somehow tax with political unfairness and discrimination has brought serious cases recently against the Democratic senator from New Jersey, a Democratic representative in Texas. And so are all of those cases of, you know, Republican weaponization of the Department of Justice against Democrats, or is that just the Department of Justice doing their job? And I think that they've been doing their job. But, you know, right now, Lincoln's party of liberty and union and the Constitution, the rule of law, has been reduced to an authoritarian cult of personality, which actually believes that Donald Trump should be able to do whatever he wants, whether it's sexually assault women, and he's an adjudicated offender, sexual offender, or commit fraud against the people of New York. He's an adjudicated fraudster, and he's a convicted felon who's out on bail right now. So then they don't believe any of those things are possible. And so they'd rather manufacture conspiracy theories about why a jury of his peers is somehow really acting in a political way.
We'll now take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk to the congressman about what he's telling his progressive constituents about why they should still vote for Harris, in spite of their concerns about the U.S. flow of weapons to Israel under the Biden-Harris administration. And stay tuned for a vigorous debate about the 14th Amendment and what happens if Donald Trump actually wins. And we're back. Let's talk about the election. You're a proud progressive. You are represent one of the most progressive precincts or corners of the state of Maryland, Tacoma Park, your hometown. And this is at a time some progressives are balking at voting for Kamala Harris because they say to do so is to continue Israeli genocide against Palestinians. When you run across folks like that, and I assume you do, what do you tell them?
Well, listen to what Kamala Harris has said. I think she expresses well the sentiment of people in the Democratic Party, which is that the strategic security of Israel is inviolable, and we have an ironclad commitment to Israel in its defense against Iran and other terrorist enemies. And at the same time, we have to be absolutely committed to human rights for the Palestinians. And we have to do whatever we can to relieve the terrible suffering that has taken place in Gaza and increasingly also in the West Bank. So as with most cases of foreign policy, and certainly in the Middle East, you have to walk a tightrope. But I think that she expresses well what the foreign policy of America should be. We've got to continue to defend our democratic ally, Israel, but we have to end the cycles of terror and war and suffering in the Middle East. This should
but
not
I,
be.
You know. Can I ask? I mean, I assume you've had some pretty impassioned conversations with some of your constituents.
Yes, like
this.
the ones who have sat in my office and, you know, picketed and interrupted my campaign events and so on. Yes, absolutely.
Oh, so there's that. Okay. Yeah. I was kind of thinking of, you know, perhaps more well-meaning people who just want to, you know, push you.
I think they're all well-meaning. I really do.
Yeah.
I think almost everybody is well-meaning across the board here. I mean, and this is why it's a situation of such tragic dimension, because there are people who, you know, understand the suffering of the Jewish people over many centuries and the expulsion of Jews from other lands and the stereotyping and the scapegoating of Jews. And understand the central importance of the survival of Israel. And there are also people who understand the absolutely tragic suffering of the Palestinians and their displacement and the violence that they've suffered through various conflicts. And those people are completely well-meaning too. And so somehow we're gonna have to put an end to these cycles of violence and terror and war. And I do believe that Kamala Harris is committed to doing that. And all I can say to them is, you know, if you want to vote for Jill Stein or not vote or, you know, do something else to try to undermine Kamala Harris, you are objectively and undeniably helping Donald Trump, Benjamin Netanyahu has been doing everything in his power to try to get elected. And that's the reality, that we have this alliance of dictators and despots and autocrats and theocrats and kleptocrats all over the earth. And they've all found each other and they're all working together to try to undermine American democracy.
But just to bring this back to where we started with Jared Kushner, though, you know, five years ago, after the, you know, horrific murder of Jamal Khashoggi, you know, the Saudis were, you know, pariahs in the world. And a presidential candidate named Joe Biden said he intended to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state. Yet when he came into office, he pursued a policy that's not all that different than the policy Donald Trump and Jared Kushner pursued. He tried to get the Saudis on board an Abraham Accords type deal to recognize the state of Israel. He went over and fist bumped, you know, the homicidal leader you just referred to earlier in this interview. And so, you know, I'm just wondering if your critique of Jared Kushner as an agent of the Saudi government might have somewhat less sting when one sees the policies of a Biden administration trying to bring along Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the Saudi government to a Mideast peace deal.
Well, look, foreign policy requires us to be committed to a set of ideals. And to my mind, those ideals, those principles must feature human rights first. And we should not be subordinating anybody's human rights to economic or strategic considerations. Human rights have got to be a categorical imperative that we put out there. You know, having said that, it is necessary to try to deal with the governments of the world to prevent World War III and to prevent regional war in the Middle East. And there's nothing that should be irreconcilable about those two different imperatives and impulses. That is, we should stand up for human rights in Saudi Arabia, which is a leading administrator of the death penalty and a violator of women's rights and a violator of the rights of religious minorities. We must stand up for freedom there and human rights in that society at the same time that we try to encourage Saudi Arabia to engage in geopolitical action that, again, promotes human rights and promotes peace and security for everybody. So I don't think those agendas are in conflict with each other. I mean, and they may be in tension at different points.
Right.
And, you know, it's like the same thing with Israel. We have to absolutely support Israel's defense of security, its strategic posture, at the same time that we must be pressing for a two-state solution and redress for the plight of the Palestinians, the vast majority of whom in Gaza have now been displaced.
Yes. Last question. The election is next Tuesday. There's been a lot of talk about whether or not Donald Trump would accept the results of the election and whether we'll have a repeat of what took place in 2020, ultimately on January 6th. But I recently saw a clip of you talking at Politics in Prose, in which, if I heard you correctly, saying that you, if Donald Trump wins the election, you will not accept his victory and you will challenge it based on your reading of the 14th Amendment. Do I have that right?
And no, you got explain. That totally wrong.
Please explain.
That's certainly the extreme right's absolute distortion and inversion of what I said there. And I'd love you to play it just so people can check it out. But I was being asked about the Supreme Court, and I was saying that the corrupted and contaminated Roberts Court has completely abdicated its responsibility. If you go back to Marbury versus Madison, the core job of the Supreme Court is to say what the law is. I was saying, on the contrary, the Supreme Court should be interpreting Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which says that anybody who has sworn an oath to support the Constitution of the United States who violates that oath by, quote, engaging in insurrection or rebellion shall never be allowed to hold federal or state office again. So the case comes up from Colorado to the Supreme Court, and the majority of the court says, no, the state of Colorado cannot make a judgment about who's on the ballot, because that would create a patchwork among the states, which is just comical because that's precisely what our system is, right? That's why Bobby Kennedy is on the ballot in some states and not others, and Jill Stein. Just to complete the thought. So they said, no, the state cannot make that judgment. All right, fine. Who's supposed to make the judgment? It's the role of the Supreme Court to say what the law is. The court should have used it as the opportunity to say whether or not Trump was barred from the ballot. But they didn't say that. The court said it's up to Congress. And then in the little snippet they've been quoting, what I said was, look how ridiculous this is. They're saying that on January 6th, Congress meeting in joint session, with all of the mobs rampaging, is going to have to make a decision about whether or not someone has violated Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Forget Donald Trump, because everybody gets their heads all confused. Imagine there's somebody who really is engaged in insurrection and everybody accepts it. What they're saying is that they're going to allow that person to go all the way up until January 6th, and then Congress has got to decide.
Okay, so just to be clear, if Donald Trump wins the election, you are not going to challenge the result on January 6th, 2025.
But I will accept the results of a free and a fair and
an honest. Now you're starting to sound like Donald Trump, Congressman. Now you're saying if it's free and fair as I define it.
Well, but you know why I'm saying that? Well, Mike, I tell you why I'm saying. I lived through 2020 where they tried to get state legislatures to change the outcome in the state and override the popular vote and implant a Trump slate of electors. I lived through 2020 when Donald Trump called up state election officials and demanded demanded that they fabricate votes, as Donald right. Trump did with Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger in Georgia, just finding 11,780 votes.
Absolutely, 100%.
When they tried to get the Vice President of the United States and other officials to unilaterally try to nullify the result. So I don't know every form of mischief that they might be up to. I don't know every form of unlawfulness they might be up to, but I will accept a lawful, honest, free, and fair election.
If the states certify, if the states certify the election, you will accept those results.
We have always accepted the certificates of ascertainment that were rendered honestly by governors based
on the
results.
Well, you challenged them. Actually, you challenged them in 2016.
Falling for more right-wing propaganda there, okay? They have made every effort to conflate two different things. The very proud bipartisan tradition of using the Electoral College joint session to raise problems in Electoral College. The one that I raised in 2016 was they had elected officials acting as electors in Florida, which is unconstitutional. That was not only the right thing to do, it remains the right thing to do. But I wasn't saying the vice president should step out of his role and nullify electoral votes. I wasn't saying mobs to overthrow the election. I mean, come on, that's ridiculous.
Okay. On the 14th Amendment, though, I just want to one point. It was a 9-0 decision, but the three Democratic appointees said, no, it's not up to us. You in Congress have to define a process for how one determines whether one engaged in insurrection. And I can see that as a very reasonable request, because what's the standard for that? Is it clear and convincing, beyond a reasonable doubt, preponderance of the evidence, 50+1? Is there an appeal process? You're going to take away somebody's right to run for office. Do they get to appeal to somebody? All that is totally unclear under the current wording of the 14th Amendment, but you, as on the judiciary, can get to work and craft a legislation that the Supreme Court asked you to do.
No, I think that the Roberts Court was perfectly well aware that the Republicans are in control of the House of Representatives. And of course, they've shown no interest in doing any of the things you just talked about, because they want to declare ab initio and in advance that there was no insurrection and Donald Trump was not an insurrectionist, right? So that's why I'm saying they have forced it to come down to January 6th, which is an incredibly irresponsible thing for the Supreme Court.
So how about legislation to define a process?
Every other part of the 14th Amendment is self-executing. Every other part of it is self-executing, and that is self-executing. It doesn't say anybody who's been found guilty of seditious conspiracy shall never be allowed to hold public office again. It says anybody who's engaged in insurrection.
I know, but that requires a process. It requires a trial. It requires a standard. Case law. Well, it requires an appeal. None of that is self-executing under the 14th Amendment. None of it.
Well, I'm sorry, Mike, but you're at this point skipping over American history. That's not the way it worked during the Reconstruction period. You think there were trials for everybody who was disqualified?
Well, then who determines who's an insurrectionist?
The Congress has determined it, and the Congress can determine it in a lot of different ways.
Well, you know, you have a Republican Congress. They didn't determine it.
And that's why a court process does
make sense.
What the Supreme Court did was very irresponsible in throwing up their hands and saying there's nothing that they could do about it. It would be up to Congress, although, of course, it would have to come back from Congress to the Supreme Court to make sure that it meets the test of congruence and proportionality so that they're the ones who get to decide.
So you're not going to draft legislation to do what the Democratic appointees on the Supreme Court asked you to do?
First of all, nobody asked us to do
anything. It said we need a process. That's what Sotomayor, Jackson, and Kagan said in their concurring opinion.
I can show you legislation that Debbie Wasserman Schultz and I introduced long before that decision was ever rendered that we want to do. And of course, the Republicans have had no interest in it. Look, here's the bottom line. The Constitution in six different places opposes insurrection. It's not just Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, right? Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15 says Congress shall have the power to call forth the militias of the states in order to repel invasions and suppress insurrections. The Treason Clause, the only place in the Constitution where a crime is defined, defines treason as levying arms against the Union. Right. The Republican Guarantee Clause, we've got a guarantee to the people of the states, a Republican form of government, and to assist them in suppressing domestic violence. OK, so this is a very big deal in the Constitution, insurrection and using violence to get your way politically. And we know that's a hallmark of authoritarianism. The Senate blew off their responsibility very irresponsibly when Mitch McConnell said, yeah, Donald Trump is factually and actually and ethically responsible for everything that happened, but we didn't have jurisdiction to hear the case. A legal point that we dismissed the first day of the trial when the Senate voted that there was jurisdiction. And of course, his point contradicts two centuries of understanding. All right, so the Senate didn't do their job. The Republican Party didn't do their job. The Supreme Court, which has been remade by Donald Trump in order to overthrow Roe versus Wade.
It was nine to nothing, including all the Democrats.
These days we think of Republicans and Democrats. Yeah, there were justices who made a terrible blunder who said that would mean that we would have different ballots in different states, which is the whole essence of the federal system, which the Supreme Court has repeatedly upheld. But in any event, yes, nine of them were mistaken. I will advance my constitutional views against nine justices on the Supreme Court. Okay, right. So the Supreme Court didn't do their job. The Republican Party didn't do their job. The Senate didn't do their job. The people have got to do their job at the ballot. And I place my faith in the people here. And there's not going to be any last minute attempt to overthrow the election and the Constitution by the Democrats. That's not how we do it. It's very clear. That's how Donald Trump and his cult followers did it in 2020. But we're not going to do that. We're going to stand by the people, which is why I've been out to 27 states. And I just got back from my sixth trip to Pennsylvania. I'm campaigning for a constitutional as well as a political victory here.
Okay. Well, on that note, I want to thank you with adding something that just occurred to me, which is that, obviously your constituents benefit from you being in Congress, but it is a loss that you're no longer teaching your constitutional law class, because I would like to sign in with that and continue these discussions.
Teaching constitutional law. It's just my Republican colleagues are not listening.
They don't take good notes. All right. Thanks a lot, Congressman.
Great to see you. Thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.com news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hockey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, High Up MAGA Guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters, because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar. Available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.